everyone, and welcome to another episode of Finally Fantasy, where we cover everything from Aerith to Zeramis.
Oh no, Vinny's taken over. Now, I know so we talked in the last episode about changing the title, but I don't think that's what it was.
Well, we were originally going to have a podcast called Talking About History, but I got shot down.
But
now I'm taking over, and we're going to be talking all about Cateau Blépas.
I'm going to assume that you're pronouncing that correctly, because I have nothing to indicate anything else.
I am probably not. Yeah. So, Cateau Blépas is like a beast with a long curved neck, and it's got one eye, and it'll petrify you. So bring along those softs or gold needles.
I'm sure that, so I don't actually understand the things that you're referencing, but I know you well enough to know that this is some kind of Final Fantasy thing.
Okay, yeah. This is a Final Fantasy thing, and this is actually how I heard about the actual topic of our podcast for the first time.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Well, this is actually primary, taking the people of the past at their word. I'm Aaron Rock.
I'm Vinny Scutiero.
And what is the topic of our show today, Vinny?
We're going to be talking about Pliny the Elder. And this was actually, when you told me the idea for this podcast, this was, my only hope that we'd cover something from Pliny?
Oh, does that mean we're done after this? We're like five episodes
this in? This is our grand finale, right?
Oh, no. I have so many
But there's a lot
things.
To cover. This is part one of the grand finale.
Okay, that's true. Okay, so it will go on for a while, because the work we're specifically going to be talking about from Pliny, he wrote quite a lot, but this is his only surviving work, and it is 37 books long, and each book has at least a dozen chapters. So we do have quite a lot to cover. So if this is the grand finale, part one, I think I'm okay with that, because we'll get to, you know, part 37 eventually, and then maybe that'll be the end. Hopefully, you know, 20 years from now or something. I don't know. It would take at least that
sounds
long
like a plan.
All right. A plan-y.
Yeah.
That's bad. So what do you already know about Pliny, Vinny?
Yeah, so this is a little odd. So I knew a little bit more about him than some of the other...
You just ignored my awesome rhyme? Okay, sorry. No. Sorry.
What? I totally Pliny, missed it. I'll hear Pliny, it when Vinny. I listen back to the episode.
Okay, yeah. Pliny, Vinny. I shouldn't have jumped in. We probably had some good recording there, and I probably just screwed it all up, but... Because your name rhymes with Pliny. I think it's nice.
Oh, well, I enjoy that. That's good.
Okay. Okay, so, yeah, what do
I
you
actually,
know about Pliny?
You know, I love Final Fantasy. And sometimes I think, oh, where'd they get the inspiration for these monsters? And for one of them, Cateau Blépas, I guess he had written a book about, you know, creatures in what is it, natural history, you said?
Yes. Yes. We will just call it natural history, because I failed Latin, and so I am no good at, and I also did not do well in Italian either. So either pronunciation of Pliny's natural history in the original language will not work well for us. So we're just going to say natural history, although I think it's, yeah, no, I'm not even going to attempt it, because I will embarrass myself and you by extension. So yes, Pliny's natural history.
So I saw that this was a creature talked about in natural history, and I looked into it just a little bit, and it seemed like this guy either just kind of made up stuff that was supposed to be real, or just like maybe saw creatures from a far distance or took stories that he told and then just put them in the book as if they were total fact. So I thought that was interesting, and
I
wanted to know more.
You have just about hit the nail on the head, actually. You've covered quite a lot in a short amount of time of what we are going to cover in a longer amount of time as we get into more details, pulling things apart, which ultimately I think is the the most fun part of history is taking something that you could cover in just a few short sentences and teasing it out and breaking it apart so that you can get the full experience of it, which is what we will do with our friend Pliny.
Pliny, can you tell me why he's called the Elder?
Okay, because there is another Pliny and he is Pliny the Younger. I mean, there's really not too much.
Is it his brother or
no,
just
actually,
some other random famous Pliny? Or
it was actually his nephew. And a lot of what we know of Pliny, and actually he sort of adopted him as a son as well. So he's kind of, you know, he's kind of his you know, his son, his nephew in a lot of ways. And a lot of the things that we know about Pliny the Elder actually does come from Pliny the Younger. So from his nephew, you know, adopted son. But so he just becomes the elder. He's the more important, I suppose.
I wonder how that would feel, because for a while he was just Pliny.
So, you know, I don't know how that would feel. I imagine it would probably be similar to just naming somebody junior. I mean, or the you know, becoming
True.
The first when somebody's the second. Sometimes I imagine there's probably some pride there, I would think.
I mean,
has
it
name.
Sounds cool to me, at least.
And, you know. And I think that the elder has a different kind of, you know, almost regality to it, doesn't it? It's just
gravitas.
Yeah. Gravitas. That's right. That's the right way to say it. But so apart from dissecting his name in every little bit, do you know anything about who he was?
Was he from ancient Greece?
You're close. He was close? Roman.
You said, yeah, when you said Italian, I was wondering.
Yeah, yeah. He was Roman, actually. He was, but you know what? We combine a lot of things from Greece and Rome. It just sort of depends on the context. But he was specifically a Roman author, and he was actually a naval commander as well. Although
Whoa.
A lot of people in Rome, especially at a with the skills that he would have had, even just knowledge that he would have had, would have taken part in the military. It was kind of a big part of what Rome was.
Right.
So he was a scholar, an author, like I said, a naval commander, an army commander, naval commander. He was a philosopher. He was, I mean, it was ancient Rome. If you had money, you were all these things.
So would his being in the Navy had anything to do with writing about natural history? Like, he was traveling a lot, he was seeing places and animals that not a lot of people got to see?
The evidence is not really. he would have done like a little bit of traveling, probably, but most of the evidence is that he didn't really see most of the things that he describes in this natural history. So we should probably, you know, elaborate on what that is specifically. So this is an early encyclopedia, basically. Pliny's Natural History is recognizable to us as something that's kind of encyclopedic. Very different, though, from what you would expect to find in a modern encyclopedia. Especially since pretty much the only modern encyclopedia is Wikipedia. just the one, and you just click through it. But it was, he was collecting information. Some of it would have been firsthand. A lot of it was just taken from other people's reports or other information that he gathered. And actually, the information is he probably didn't even do any of the writing himself. I think it's Pliny the Younger who described that he did most of his dictation, I suppose, to these scribes that he had, and he was in the bath at the time, so he's just just rambling on while someone takes this all down, which is just
even
so
more gravitas.
Roman. Yeah, just yeah. So very Roman. So that is.
I assume
the
someone
subject.
Would have been fanning him and then feeding
Almost
him
definitely.
Grapes.
Grapes, probably, right? Yeah, with you know, he had a like laurel leaf, you yeah. know, headband and stuff. Almost certainly. So, he decided I mean, he had written quite a few things. Unfortunately, this is the only work of his that still survives. And he probably still, the other things that he wrote on similar subjects probably were also written by other people. Scribes.
All right. So taken down. Do we know why he would have wanted to start this project? Is it something, were there other encyclopedias at the time, or was he just like, someone needs to chronicle all of this knowledge?
You know, I don't know his specific motivations, except that he dedicated this to the Emperor Titus. So it may have been something that was maybe requested by the Emperor as well. Sometimes that's the way that things like this happened. But he was actually, Titus was actually the son of a friend of his, because Pliny was friends with another emperor. So Vespasian was the emperor and then had his son Titus, who then became the emperor. And so it was kind of this, dedication to them. But I think he was just sort of, he was generally scholarly and, you know, he was at a point where he really wasn't doing quite a lot of, I don't know, what you might consider regular work. So he just sort of took advantage of some of the information that he knew he had collected and decided to compile it into one kind of compendium, just to have it so that everybody could have this encyclopedic collection.
So who would have had access to this? Would this have been like in a library and people could go read the information, or would people actually have copies of this?
There may have been some folks who would have been wealthy enough to have a copy of it. Certainly there would have been there would have been copies in larger libraries. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Library of Alexandria.
Yes.
And unfortunately, because things were so rarely duplicated, because it was so expensive, there were a lot of one-off copies of things. And when the Library of Alexandria in Egypt burned, a lot of things were lost. In fact, that may be
why. Is that why most of his stuff, or everything but this, was lost?
It certainly might have been a contributing factor. I don't know specifically where all of Pliny's documents were stored, but when we're talking about something 2,000 years on it, and when we're talking about paper especially or even papyrus, it does not want to last very long, especially in an environment as kind of damp as the Mediterranean.
Right. So how long would it have taken to write this?
It took it took him quite a while, and actually he was not even finished with it. He had not finished kind of editing it when he before he died. So most of the writing, it seems like he did, you know, at night from the bath, basically. So even more gravitas being at night. And it would have definitely taken quite some time to get all of this together. Even just reading through it at that order would have at that kind of time would have taken a while. So most reports are that he started it maybe in 77 AD and then was finished with it in 79 AD, not necessarily intentionally, but that happened to be when he died. So in fact, we know the exact day that Pliny died, which is very rare for somebody for this time period to know the exact date. And
I almost don't want to know.
Oh, well, we can save it for the end if you want. It'd be the kind of big reveal. But it's one of the... I'm so fascinated by Pliny.
I knew he was not still around, but...
I hope so. Because, man, what a guy that would be, right? I wonder if he would get other things more correct.
Right, yeah. Time. So why don't we mention specifically what we're going to be looking at, since we're not going to be doing all 30-plus chapters today.
I know, because for some reason you don't want to do all 37 books of Pliny's Natural History. So
I just want to spread it out. I'm not saying that we can't eventually do all of them.
Well, we definitely don't want to step on the toes of Sawbones too much, who talks about Pliny quite a lot when it comes to some of the medical, you know, with some of his medical recommendations. But we will specifically be talking about Book 8, Chapter 10, and Book 7, Chapter 13. Two kind of unrelated subjects, I think, it's fair to say. One deals with the subject of elephants, and it's only one of the many chapters that deals with elephants. It talks about
elephants. I was looking at the contents, and it seems so scattershot, like, oh, these are the facts that he decides to include about elephants, and then I noticed the title was something like, you know, Elephant Miscellaneous. Like all exactly. The stuff that didn't fit into all the other chapters I wrote about elephants.
All the previous elephant chapters, exactly. And then Book 7, Chapter 13, I think I just need to read. So actually, let me read the title of the elephant one since we did say. So specifically, Book 8, Chapter 10 is The Birth of the Elephant and Other Particulars Respecting It. And then Book 7, Chapter 13 is Remarkable Circumstances Connected with the Menstrual Discharge. So, not related, but both immensely fascinating in their own way, and both relatively short as well.
Yeah, it is very interesting to see. I guess it's just weird to see what he decides is important to mention, and the two chapters seem very different in how, like, almost scientific they are, or not scientific.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is pre-science, actually. This is before science existed in the form that we're familiar with. So I feel like it's also important to talk about the structure of natural history before we dive into the books
Sure.
themselves that we're going to do. So he covers not just animals and menstruation, not just those two things, although I suppose you could fill plenty of books with just those things. But he covers, it's an encyclopedia. He covers, I mean, almost every topic you could think of, you know, astronomy and math and human physiology and zoology and minerals and horticulture and agriculture and the nature of the universe, or down, you know, the nature of the universe, or the specifics of what, like, a certain rock could be used for. I mean, there's...
Well, it's so interesting. It's like, I've always wanted to learn math from a guy who has kind of heard about math.
Yeah, that is sort of the way that this and we can learn about the world from a guy who's sort of heard about the,
yeah, like, he knows a guy that knows about the world, so
exactly. But the structure of this actually is fairly logical if you're talking about an ancient Roman perspective. So he uses Aristotle's division of nature, basically. So animal, vegetable, and mineral. So that's how he chooses to divide up these kind of chapters and these kind of books and these kind of segments. So he starts with the
broader... Where does math fall in that?
That's specifically when he's dealing with the nature of everything, or with
nature
itself.
I see.
So he, well, what is it Carl Sagan that said, who is it that said, you know, in order to make an apple pie, you must first create the universe. I think that's kind of the, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that's how I see Pliny basically starting this out. So he starts with the nature of the universe and the nature of the world. And those are the earlier books. And then he works down to, you know, animal, vegetable, mineral, natural world.
And the very last page is just a really kick-ass apple pie recipe.
Exactly. Because you've already created the universe. Oh man, now you've got me thinking about a pie history that we could also include. I've got some excellent primary sources about the history of pie, both the number and the food stuff. So that's definitely something we can talk about in the future.
All right. Look forward to that.
All right. So back to the idea of science, of, you know, from somebody who only has a little understanding of science. This is before science became the thing that you and I would recognize as science. The thing that turned into science is natural history, is what was called natural history. The interactions of the knowledge of the natural world, the natural order, whether that is dealing with the stars and the planets or elephants and the human body. That is what eventually evolved into science. And as you have already, as we've both already kind of hinted at, whereas science today is based entirely on direct observation, you need to make sure that you see and experience something yourself in order to relate it, in order to actually, you know, teach it or understand it more. That is not the case when you're dealing with natural history of the ancient world, when you're dealing with this pre-science. So now that we know kind of what he is and is not trying to talk about, so he's not really talking about science the way we'd recognize it, but he's talking about, you know, scientific related things.
Yeah, that becomes very apparent when you read it.
So, when we read it, well, let's specifically talk about, let's start out with elephants, even though the other one technically comes earlier in the encyclopedia, but I think the elephants are more interesting to start out with. So.
Sure.
So what, how does it become apparent, Vinny, that he doesn't, that it's not very scientific?
Well, he says, at one point he specifically says that he found it stated what happens if they drink oil, saying that, like, weapons won't stick to them as much.
I find it stated that on making them drink oil, any weapons which will happen to stick to their body will fall out, while on the contrary, perspiration makes them more readily adhere.
And it just totally sounds like, yeah, I knew a guy who tried to, like, I don't know, stab an elephant and his knife just slipped right off because he was drinking oil or something. It's very much like, I have a friend of a friend who this happened to, or like, I heard from someone who heard from someone that this weird thing happens when elephants drink oil.
Yep. And that is a lot of how Pliny gathered his information. He is referencing other sources, which frankly is not that unlike a modern encyclopedia. They don't necessarily go out and research things. They pull information from other places. I mean, they don't go and experience things themselves. So the funny thing about this is, about this particular fact, we'll say, what happens if they drink oil, is that there, even if Pliny had never been to India or Africa, which he probably hadn't, where elephants naturally were, there were probably at least a few elephants in Rome during his lifetime. They actually, they would frequently bring them into the to places like the Colosseum for, you know, for battles. I mean, they were used by the military when they could get them, because they are such great kind of war animals. They're so large and everything. So the Romans really kind of enjoyed elephants to a degree. So this would have actually been like a thing that he probably could have seen.
I wasn't thinking about elephants being used in a gladiatorial context, because I was wondering why he would even include something about whether weapons would stick to them or not stick to them. But I guess if that's what elephants are doing in your life, that's the kind of stuff you'd want to know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they were certainly used in war contexts and in gladiatorial contexts. There is even the during the Second Punic War, which is outside the scope of this conversation, but a few hundred years before Pliny's writing, Hannibal crossed the Alps with elephants as part of his kind of war entourage. That's not really the right word. It's kind of his you know, group of war people, whatever you'd call that. So there's
army.
Yeah, that's it. That's the word. Army. That's the thing. So Hannibal's,
yeah,
army.
War entourage.
Yeah, war entourage. You know, they, you know, he had elephants with him, And so it wasn't unusual for them to be used where there were weapons around. So this reference to elephants and weapons is not unexpected. So, but what's very interesting, he talks about what happens if they drink oil, but if they're sweating, then he goes into that, right? Like if they're,
yeah,
if the elephants are sweating, then weapons will stick to them. So, I mean, it seems like he's not really full of, it's not like he doesn't really have a solution to this, because in what situation would you be, you'd have to get them to drink a lot of oil, probably.
Well, yeah, that's why it's so weird. It's like, it's almost like a how-to, like he's telling you this, such a random fact that it seems like, okay, I know you want to hurt an elephant, and I'm not telling you to, but I'll tell you what makes it harder and what makes it easier. I'm not going to tell you how to make them sweat or how to make them drink oil, but I'm just putting it out there just in case.
Again, this just goes to Pliny attempting to just collect the information that he knew was available. So he sees somebody, he finds it stated that, you know, weapons won't stick to them if they drink oil. And then,
well, he
so
even
just...
puts in two conflicting opinions right at the very beginning. He's talking about how long it takes them to give birth. And he's like, well, one guy says, you know, it takes 10 years, but another guy said it only takes 2 years.
The vulgar notion is that the elephant goes with young 10 years, but according to Aristotle, it is 2 years only.
So, here you go.
So there you go.
It's probably one of those.
And this, again, speaks to more of Pliny not knowing this stuff. He is, I mean, I just now imagine this Roman, you know, this Roman retired army commander, basically, sitting in the bath, just saying, well, you know, I remember so-and-so saying something about elephants drinking oil, and then, you know, you don't have elephants. And then he also said that it takes, you know, this many years for them to gestate, basically. And, you know, that's it. But then somebody else mentioned this. So, yeah, just put that down. Just put both those things down, just in case.
He does say the 10 years thing is a vulgar notion, but then he credits Aristotle for the 2 years. So is he saying, oh, the 10 years thing is probably wrong because it's vulgar, or is...
Yes, and he
I don't
is,
really get where he's coming from there.
I think he probably is. He is using almost definitely a different version or a different meaning of the word vulgar than you're maybe suspecting.
I kind of thought that, so I figured it might just mean like the popular notion or like word
exactly.
on the street is.
Exactly. So vulgar in this case means the popularly thought notion, not necessarily that it's a modern vulgarity where it's you know, rude or inappropriate.
Right. So, like so I was at an opera and I mentioned that it takes elephants 10 years and, you know, someone fainted and their monocle popped off.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the 2 year thing, which as you rightly said, he credits to Aristotle, is actually pretty close to the truth.
I was going to say, I don't know much about elephants, so I didn't, like, how much of what he's saying is right?
Very little, but this part, but this part actually gets pretty close. Depending on the species of elephant, you know, it can take anywhere from like 18 to 22 months, for elephant gestation.
That's pretty close.
And that can vary within a species, because some animals will gestate for less predictable amounts of time, depending on their environment and whether it's appropriate, whether they have enough food and water or anything. They can actually hold on to animal, you know, to their young for longer. They can hold on to them in the womb. So 22 months, pretty close to 2 years. So
all right, yeah.
So that's at least one
good on
thing.
Aristotle.
Yes, good job,
yeah,
Aristotle.
Like,
getting
he,
one.
He
thing
also
right
mentions
also.
That they're not able to swim, and I'm almost certain that's not true.
Yeah, that is not true. They don't often swim because they are rarely in a place that has deep enough water for them to swim.
Right.
It comes down more to size, but they are perfectly capable of swimming.
And then he also says they're immune from disease.
Yep.
Like, wow, no disease. That's pretty impressive. Like,
yep, they suffer no disease, period. End of story. I don't even know. I think I even saw one scholar refuting this, just saying as simple as this is untrue. Just like period.
Just like footnote. End of book. They gets it.
Yeah. Especially, you know what? Pliny actually contradicts himself, doesn't he, here? Because then he says, because he mentions leeches with elephants as well, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. He says if they accidentally drink a horse leech, then they have intolerable pain.
They experience the greatest torture if they happen to swallow, while drinking, a horse leech, an animal which people are beginning, I find, to call almost universally a bloodsucker. The leech fastens upon the windpipe and produces intolerable pain.
I guess it's not
a really disease, a disease, but I would consider it kind of close. It's
And that, again, is just such a random fact. I know this is the miscellaneous extra facts about elephants, but it just seems, it's so scattershot. He's like, this is how long it takes for them to be born. This is, you know, what happens if they drink a leech. This is what happens if they eat dirt.
Yeah. And you know what? What he describes, he describes what happens if they drink a leech, I imagine, is pretty similar to what happens to just about any creature if
right.
it drinks a leech, right? It fastens upon the windpipe, produces intolerable pain, because it is a bloodsucker. I mean, it is...
Right. He was getting paid by the word, and that sentence is in every chapter about every animal.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, yep. Yeah, cheetahs, if they get bitten by leech. Unicorns, if they get bitten by leech. Because he does mention unicorns in here, and dragons.
Sweet.
And everything else.
That's the kind of stuff that made me interested.
Yep. It's quite something. He gets quite a few facts wrong. He gets some things about anatomy wrong. If we're talking about swallowing, let's point out this particular segment where he says, they eat with the mouth, but they breathe, drink, and smell with the proboscis, which is not unaptly termed their hand. So he's saying that they drink through their, what we would understand as the elephant's nose. They certainly can breathe through there, but they take in water with their trunk. But they do not actually drink through their trunk.
Right.
That would be very difficult to do. Those systems don't actually connect. So they will take in water, but then transfer it to their mouths in order to drink. So somebody could observe an elephant doing this and think that they are drinking straight through the trunk, the proboscis.
You know, I was never grossed out by that before. But now I'm thinking like, oh yeah, that's their nose.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Yeah.
Just imagine drinking water that came out of your nose.
That's what I exactly don't want to do.
So he gets quite a few quite a few things wrong. However, my favorite thing that he gets wrong here, we have not yet gotten to. So I think we've skipped around it a little bit, but this is something that a lot of people will recognize as what they will think is truth of elephants, but is in fact a myth that comes from this piece, from Pliny. Do you know what I'm talking
about? I was wondering about that. The fact that they're afraid of mice?
Exactly. They have the greatest aversion to the mouse of all animals.
Oh.
MythBusters has even tried to test this. And they are not as averse to mice. They are not any more averse to mice than any other species of animal, basically, if you just draw a random lot.
So I had heard that wasn't true. And I just assumed that he was writing about some common misconception even of that time. But you're saying, like, this is where that comes from, just
exactly.
The fact that Wow, very interesting.
Depending on the source you look at, even now, people are still continuing to test this. So some other scholars from ancient times would have confirmed this as well. They are likely also citing either Pliny himself or the source that Pliny would have gotten this from. So it's kind of, you know, fruit of the poisonous tree, so to speak. But it continues to this day. I mean, we see it in cartoons pretty often. It is, like I said, Mythbusters handled it at some point and disproved it. They certainly would
and quite loathe their food as it lies in the manger if they perceive that it has been touched by one of those animals.
Elephants are smart, and they would be smart enough to not eat food that has been contaminated by mice or by too much mouse presence, because that could have contaminated it and dirtied it. So I can see that happening.
Right. Like, it's like he's talking about about elephants so high and mighty, like they won't even eat food that mice touch, idiots. And he's like snacking on contaminated, you know, grapes, I guess, that mice have walked all over.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, no, dude, yeah, you shouldn't either. You should definitely leave that stuff alone. So that is just one. I won't spoil our, you know, grand finale part, you know, part 46 or something, but that is just one of many still commonly thought animal myths that comes from Pliny's natural history. So to say
really?
That
oh,
this
cool.
is impactful.
I'll be excited to learn more.
Yeah, I'm tempted to tell you a few more, but I will not spoil it.
Let me ask you, did he include any sources? Like, I know every once in a while he'll say, oh, Aristotle thought this, like, in the actual text, but was there something, like, at the end of this book that credits anyone, or, I mean...
Not really. I mean, he will, as you said, mention sources as he keeps going. He does in the index list a few, you know, authorities that he would have been referencing or consulting, but it's certainly not exhaustive in any way. Most of the time, if he's mentioning somebody, it's he'll list it in the text itself. Let me see here. He claimed to have stated 20,000 facts gathered from 2,000 books from 100 different authors. So that's what he says early
that
on.
That just seems like what he put on, like, the book jacket or something.
The book jacket, exactly.
This book contains over 20,000 facts.
The Emperor Titus approves. So it's, he pulls from a lot of places. And they certainly can't all have been right. And they certainly wouldn't all have had direct knowledge of whatever he is talking about either. So this is the ancient Roman game of telephone, just in writing and having survived for thousands of years.
So I can kind of get that with elephants. I don't see how some of the facts he gets wrong about menstruation could possibly be believed. but you
Wait,
know
you
elephants
think they were
you know
just
maybe
act.
He never saw any but it seems like there's no way he could have like not come across experiences in his life that didn't directly contradict the things he says in the next book we're gonna cover.
I mean, do you think he's just gonna go ask a woman about some of this stuff, Vinny?
Well, you wouldn't even need to do that. I mean, should we talk about the next chapter?
Yes, let's talk about Book 7, Chapter 13. The wonderful, you know, mystical, apparently, world of you know, menstruation. What jumps out at you first? I mean, there's so many things that we could look at here.
Okay,
so let's start with one.
The thing that jumps out at me is the paragraph where he just keeps... It's like he's playing this weird game with himself. He's trying to top each example. So he's saying, oh, yeah, menstruating is it's a pretty interesting thing because when a woman's menstruating, any seeds she touches become sterile and... Oh, and by the way, fruits fall from trees. Oh, and mirrors will dim and bees will just die.
So and if a dog eats the discharge, they will become, their bite will become venomous and they'll turn mad. And
on the approach of a woman in this state, must will become sour. Seeds which are touched by her become sterile. Grafts wither away. Garden plants are parched up, and the fruit will fall from the tree beneath which she sits. Her very look, even, will dim the brightness of mirrors, blunt the edge of steel, and take away the polish from ivory. A swarm of bees, if looked upon by her, will die immediately. Brass and iron will instantly become rusty and emit an offensive odor, while dogs, which may have tasted of the matter so discharged, are seized with madness, and their bite is venomous and incurable.
Yes, it's bizarre, right?
So, I mean, that's what I'm saying, like, he didn't ever come across a woman who was menstruating and a mirror, like, I guess were mirrors that uncommon? I mean, like, it just seems, or a fruit tree, like, I can't imagine he actually believed any of these things. Like, is this like his comedy set? Like, he has a... you know, a quick 5 minutes about menstruation or something?
No, I mean, once again, he is citing existing beliefs and existing sources. He, some of the things that he cites about, about seeds, turning fallow or bees, disappearing or whatever it is. Oh man, is that what's happening to the bees?
No, he says they'll die immediately.
Yeah, is that what's happening to our bees now? Is it women? Are we destroying? Am I destroying the bees? But maybe Pliny was right. It's not colony collapse. It's female menstruation.
Quick, go check a mirror.
Well, not right now. I'm good. So, some of this comes from religious texts. Some of this about women being unclean during menstruation, comes straight out of Leviticus. And so it comes from existing Jewish beliefs and existing religious beliefs. Granted, the Romans didn't necessarily subscribe to those, but they certainly were around.
I mean, to me, this goes beyond unclean and is just like superpowers. It's just like... like
dim
like
mirrors.
Women should have been elevated if you believe this stuff. It's like okay we've got a problem with bees, like let's like we need help, like
don't anger the women, they'll come around as they're menstruating. Let me just quote one particular commentary I saw from some of the folks who compiled who edited or notated the text, the version of natural history that we've been reading off of. So one of the scholars whose name I do not see because they start using abbreviations, it just says fairly simply, all of the poisonous and noxious effects, et cetera, are without the slightest foundation. Just like that's it. There's nothing else to say. It's not true. How do we say that it's not true? And
I mean, would any of so people were reading this and just taking it seriously? Like to them, this was like this part of the book had just as much basis in reality as the part about elephants giving birth.
Yep. This is also, I feel like it's fair to mention, just like it's before the existence of science, this is kind of also before the existence of fiction, as you would recognize it. So that's not to say that's not to say that stories didn't exist and that people didn't tell tales that weren't 100% truth. I mean, that's what legends are. There were certainly, morality stories that would be told to people for, that weren't meant to contain 100% real truth. But things that were written were pretty much seen as real. And the truth. There was this kind of pact that existed between the writer and the reader that the things that they were putting down were correct and accurate as much as possible.
Very interesting.
So fiction, as we kind of recognize it as this source of entertainment, that you have this other pact where it says, all right, we're going to suspend belief for a while and tell you something entertaining just for the sake of being entertaining. That doesn't come about for another few centuries, really. I think more than a thousand years, actually. So it gradually kind of comes about. So just the fact that this was in writing implies an understood truth, which I'm also going to say doesn't necessarily mean that everybody would have taken every single element of this and thought that it was 100% completely accurate. It would just be the most accurate possible, basically, that nobody was trying to deceive anybody, that the author perceived this as true, and that it was as verifiable as possible.
Interesting.
So this is pre-science, pre-fiction. So no science fiction for sure, because, you know, both of those things. And that is where I'm just gonna tease a little bit more of some other content in natural history. That is where it gets complicated, that in addition to including real animals that were known to exist, elephants and lions and ostriches and whales, that Pliny's inclusion of dragons and unicorns and what was the other thing?
Catoblepas.
Yeah, sure, that one. that becomes a little complicated, because the question is, okay, did he know it wasn't real and included it anyway? I always just assumed
that, kind of like what you were saying, was part telephone, part just like, oh, we saw, you know, what was it? Like, people think maybe mermaids is just, you would see manatees at a distance or something.
Dolphins, right.
Right. So I just kind of assumed it was a Mr. Magoo situation where, mm-hmm. like, there was
I think there's some of that.
Something that looked like a unicorn, but, you know, maybe it was an antelope that had one of its horns broken off or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is some of that too. It's that same you tell someone who then tells someone who then tells someone, and they saw something strange anyway. I mean, that's how, you know, most myths really get started. But there's maybe even some indication that some of this stuff he just knew outright was like, you know. Yeah, I know dragons aren't real. We're probably talking about giant lizards. You know, we'll include this anyway because I have somebody who's saying that they are. And,
I can't imagine that he, for even a moment, thought that a menstruating woman would be able to kill bees.
I'm sorry to say,
I just can't
Vinny,
imagine it.
I'm sorry to say, Vinny, that I can imagine that there
or blunt the edge of steel. How about that?
Yeah, that would be pretty impressive power, wasn't it?
Right?
Yeah, if I could just do that just by existing and doing something completely natural. But so that is those are kind of the crazier things. But really, almost everything that he mentions here is just false.
Yeah. So he starts up at the very top. He's talking about moles. Mm-hmm. Which apparently exist inside of people, and they move around, and they can't be cut or poked or something. And in whose womb are found what we term moles. These moles consist of a shapeless mass of flesh, devoid of all life, and capable of resisting either the edge or the point of the knife. They are movable in the body and obstruct the menstrual discharge. Sometimes, too, they are productive of fatal consequences to the woman, in the same manner as a real fetus, while at other times, they remain in the body until old age. In some cases, again, they are discharged in consequence of an increased action of the bowels. Is that a real thing that we know it as something else?
Yes. So this is something that I was not familiar with until, until reading this more carefully. So I am not a... I'm not, I don't have any medical training. I'm not a doctor of any kind, but what I was able to to find out is that this is actually a tumor. He is actually talking about a specific tumor that exists. That does grow inside the uterus.
So he's just talking about like ovarian cancer or something?
Not really, because it turns out that this is actually, based on the sources that I was able to find, this is actually the result of abnormal conception. So it is basically an empty egg that has been fertilized. So it's not going to pass along any genetic material. It's not going to actually, it's not. It's usually not even going to implant. And if it does, it's just a basically a mass of tissue. So it's a fairly specific, at least one version of a mole. A hydatidiform. Hold on, let me try that one more time. A hydatidiform mole is specifically what I was able to find information about. So
that's really interesting. This was the kind of stuff that I was more expecting from this book, like things that they thought at the time that had like somewhat of a basis in reality that they just didn't fully understand yet, that we now would have known a lot more. And I guess there's some of that in the elephant chapter. But most of the stuff in the elephant chapter seems just totally pulled from thin air. And then this chapter even more seems so just so completely off the wall. So I'm surprised. I was expecting the entire book to read like that first chapter.
Yeah, and he actually manages to get this one, this one thing kind of right. He sort of is kind of weirdly, focused on it. It's trying to think of how best to characterize this. He's describing these moles. It's a shapeless mass of flesh, devoid of all life, and then he kind of. He mentions that they're sometimes fatal, which is probably how they found out about them in the first place through dissections after a woman maybe died unexpectedly, or worse, frankly. But it is, it's, he's kind of weirdly like, I don't know, enamored with it by my reading. He's just like, it's sometimes they stay there through old age, and sometimes they're discharged. And I mean, he kind of just covers all his bases. He's like, oh, they can be there and they can obstruct the menstrual discharge, or they can just be like shed or whatever. You can't cut them with a knife, but then maybe they stay in the body forever, and maybe they don't. It's just a little bit of like, I know there's this thing that can sometimes be in there, but and sometimes there's something similar that shows up in a man, which is just another, the thing that he mentions is just another, it's just another type of tumor. I wasn't able to see that it's specifically male, but maybe that was just the experience that they'd encountered at the time.
Well, maybe he was just really proud to actually have a fact. So he just... He was just so excited, like, wow, I actually know something I can include here instead of just making it up. And also, he specifically calls out.
Yeah.
Well, that seems so mean to me. He's like, oh, yeah, so here's this tumor that are in women. Oh, yeah, and men have something similar. And specifically, this one guy did. Like, that just seems cruel.
Yeah, I think it is a little mean. I'm not sure. I'm not sure who Opius Capito was, but I hope he survived.
He was a man of Praetorian rank. You know that.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. And he had a tumor, somewhere on his body. I think we can maybe fill in some blanks there. But that's actually, he talks about the moles, but that's actually not really the first fact that he throws out there.
Right. I forgot. Yeah. He says that human females are the only living beings that menstruate. Among the whole range of animated beings, the human female is the only one that has the monthly discharge.
Yep.
Which, that is not true.
It is not as far from the truth as I expected, but it's not true. So some animals do. So menstruation specifically is the shedding of the uterine lining and discharging it, basically. So like that whole process. So if there's not a fertilized egg, the uterine lining has swollen to kind of try to receive a fertilized egg. And then if it does not get one, then it just gets really mad and just decides to make everything terrible for a couple of days. And then, you know, sheds that completely and sheds it completely outside of the body. So that whole process is menstruation. Some other apes, some old world monkeys, apparently elephant shrews, and like some bats and like one specific rodent species, the spiny mouse, they do that same thing. They shed that lining and usually externally. Most other mammal species reabsorb the womb lining instead of shedding it out. Mm-hmm. So it changes their interaction with how frequently they're able to fertilize. It certainly seems safer if it's a species that has lots of predators. So it's different and not exactly the same. So they still go through these sort of cycles, although some animals, instead of it being a predictable cycle, will instead have that kind of reaction to the presence, the female will have that reaction to the presence of a male. Will basically just enter that reproductive cycle when a male or males are around. So they'll react to the hormones. So instead of it being cyclical, it is reactionary. So it is kind of considered a different thing, which I was surprised to find out as well, because I thought too, like, no, really? No, that can't be true.
Yeah, but I guess I didn't have any experience to say otherwise, but I just thought that there was no way that could have been true. So, I guess that makes sense. He probably didn't come across any of those animals you mentioned.
Yeah, I doubt he'd would be able to identify an elephant shrew. He would probably just say, oh, I know that. Elephants are afraid of that thing. Because he does specifically say the human female is the only one that has the monthly discharge. So he's not just talking about...
Oh, that's true. Cycle. Yeah, he's... So... Okay, so, well,
I don't think he intentionally.
You got me this time, Pliny. Point Pliny.
Yep. So there are a couple more things that that Pliny seems to think, the miraculous menstrual discharge is capable of also achieving. So this one I find particularly bizarre. Because it's so strangely specific that it would have to be based on somebody.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, somebody getting into it somehow or trying this, I guess.
All right, I know what you're talking about. It almost seems like that part seems like a how-to guide, but I didn't understand it at all.
Okay, yes, it is kind of a how-to guide. So he's saying certain times of the year, floating on the lake in Lake of Judea, there is this sticky substance that shows up, and if you dip a string in this discharge, then you can actually easily separate this sticky substance, which just, it's grossing me out just thinking about it, actually.
In addition to this, the bitumen, which is found at certain periods of the year, floating on the Lake of Judea, known as asphaltites, a substance which is peculiarly tenacious and adheres to everything that it touches, can only be divided into separate pieces by means of a thread which has been dipped in this virulent matter. Why would you want to? So he called it bitumen?
Yes. Sometimes it's also referred to as bituminous rock. And there's a hint to what it is in the other name that he gives. He says, floating on the Lake of Judea, known as Asphaltites. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong.
Asphaltites, I think.
Asphaltites. There we go. Asphaltites. So the Lake of Judea. So the asphalt. Asphaltites. It's asphalt. It's asphalt.
Is that actually what asphalt is?
Yes, it is a black viscous mixture of hydrocarbons obtained naturally or as a residue from petroleum distillation, used for road surfacing and roofing. So it is a naturally occurring substance, asphalt, basically. So he's saying, oh, you can slice asphalt, basically, if you dip a string in menstrual fluid.
What in the world?
And
who would have thought to try that?
I don't know, but I don't know for sure that he's wrong either. Like, maybe? I'm not about to go try it, but like...
Right.
But like, I don't know. It's, although in that same thing, in that same paragraph, so he's talking about asphalt, he's, you know, and here's your how-to on how to separate pieces of asphalt, and then he's like, also, by the way, ants.
Right. It's like, oh, I forgot to mention that ants also hate it. It is said that the ant, even an insect so extremely minute, is sensible of its presence and rejects the grains which it has been carrying and will not return to them again. Back in my
that should have been in the earlier paragraph, but I'll just put it in here. They'll even just, you know, whatever grains they were carrying, they'll just leave them and just forget about it. Because I imagine maybe the ants were watching somebody attempt this asphalt division. And they're like, oh, I am no longer hungry. And once and we're all a hive mind, so once everybody else hears this thing that just happened, they're not going to be hungry for this either. We're just going to leave this little piece of grain right here. You guys, weird humans.
It's so strange. Because he says all that stuff at the beginning about the moles, and then at the end, it's this very, you know, pretty standard thing about, you know, I guess, how someone becomes pregnant and kind of what, like, the actual function of menstruation is. But then the whole middle thing is just like, steel will be destroyed and mirrors and, oh, you know, this substance that is too hard to cut can be separated with this thread. So it's the whole thing was very bizarre. And I mean, to someone who was really looking forward to reading it, it was a big surprise. I can't tell yet if I'm pleasantly surprised or a little disappointed in him. I guess maybe I was expecting too much, but I don't know. It was certainly fun to read.
Oh, I feel like there's one more little thing that he mentions that he sort of almost gets right, since we've gotten all the things that he gets wrong. He does point out that the whole point of this process is basically bearing children, that this is somehow related to becoming pregnant, and that women who don't have this discharge are not often capable of bearing children, and that he also knows somehow that the seed of the male, you know, it acts as a leaven.
Is involved,
Right, exactly. So these two things combine somehow and form a human. And
this discharge, which is productive of such great and singular effects, occurs in women every 30 days and in a greater degree every 3 months. In some individuals, it occurs oftener than once a month, and in others, again, it never takes place. Women of this nature, however, are not capable of bearing children, because it is of this substance that the infant is formed. The seed of the male, acting as a sort of leaven, causes it to unite and assume a form, and in due time it acquires life and assumes a bodily shape.
So he's not too far off from that. He's not too far off from right, but yeah, everything he hits in between is just out there. I mean, I don't know what he thinks, like, just insects, I guess, mostly. Just really, just stand no chance against a menstruating woman.
Right. And dogs gain superpowers when they interact.
Yeah, that's true. So women are awesome. Pliny says so. He says that we have superpowers. And I think we should just go with that. Although I imagine we probably still would suffer intolerable pain if swallowing a leech.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he doesn't say
I didn't see that in this paragraph yet, but I'm assuming this isn't the only one about humans, so it's got to be in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Intolerable pain when a leech attaches to your windpipe. And all of this is just why I love Pliny so much, because I just, this guy sitting in his comfortable bath by oil lantern light, just reeling off this information to some poor scribes that he's hired, or that the Emperor Titus has hired, to just take all of this down. Excuse me. This will be my legacy.
Fine.
And
he
I
was
won't
right,
be able
right?
to finish it. I won't be able to finish it though, because I die before it's complete. And remember me telling you we know the exact date.
So why was that?
Because he died after the eruption of Mount Vesuvius that buried Pompeii and Herculaneum.
And sunk Atlantis.
That's actually an earlier thing. The myth of Atlantis actually existed before this, but that could be another thing. So he was not directly killed in the eruption. He was not in Pompeii.
Oh, so we don't have a cool, like, Pliny statue.
No. He and others, including his nephew, Pliny the Younger, saw the eruption from a distance, saw it happen, and had friends and others that they really wanted to attempt to save. So they had a ship. A few of them traveled to attempt a rescue of whoever they could save. And he, the reports were, basically died after their first night because of the toxic
smoke inhalation or something.
Exactly. So they basically
did Pliny the Younger survive that night?
Yes, he did. So they kind of settled down one night to say, okay, we've made it across, we made it across the water. We'll do whatever rescue attempts we can. Well, let's get some rest. And he just didn't wake up. So as a result, we know he died August 25th, AD 79. Quite a specific for this time period. It is very specific. We don't know exactly when he was born, but we know the day he died, which is
for 2000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, that's an okay way to go. You're trying to do some good at the end there.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, they were really trying something fairly heroic. He was maybe, as a man in his mid-50s, maybe not the best equipped to be making that kind of trip, but I don't think they could have anticipated how dangerous really it was.
But, I mean, if they didn't know that mirrors didn't lose their brightness when a woman was menstruating, I can't imagine they understood that being near, a previously active volcano was dangerous.
I guess that's probably true. It was pretty much still active, actually. It was during one of what's called the pyroclastic surges. It was like the sixth one. So there was still, on a pretty regular basis, gas and rock fragments spewing from this volcano.
Oh, wow.
So really,
I know less about volcanoes than history, so.
Oh, well, I can't
Do we need to change the topic of the podcast?
Yeah, you need to change co-hosts too, because I don't know anything about volcanoes more than I can read on the internet. So I know I wouldn't want to be near one. Those are just two chapters of Pliny's natural history.
Well, and there's plenty more to come in the future, so I'm looking forward to it.
Did you say there's plenty more to come?
I didn't.
Well, shame on you then for not saying that. I got it, though. So thank you all for listening to Primary, taking the people of the past at their word. I'm Aaron Rock.
I'm Vinny Squitiro. And remember, do not drink horse leeches. Just don't do it. It's a bad idea.
Intolerable pain.
You don't look interested in what I just said. If you're not listening, then don't nod your head.
This has been Primary, produced and edited by me, Chris Rock. visit our website at primaryshow.com. Follow us on Twitter at primaryshow. Aaron is at Arema, A-R-A-E-M-A, and Vinny is Blueberry Bark. Thank you to Jonathan Colton for use of the song Sticking to Myself off the album Artificial Heart as our intro and outro music. This has been a production of Rock Squid Media LLC. All rights reserved.
First up, we have a passage about elephants. First up, we have a passage about those big gray buddies. First up, we have a passage about big gray animals. Let's see if you can figure out what...